Side Door is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
This is Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian. I'm Megan Dietrich, and my co-host Tony Cohn is out on assignment this week, so you guys are stuck with just me. Today, I've got three stories about people finding clever ways around the rules. Loopholes come in a bunch of shapes, from skimping on taxes to pirating music, and people have gotten pretty inventive about finding the cracks in the system. I'm going to kick it off by pulling up the U.S. Post Office's website and reading to you the remarkably short list of things that you just cannot send in the mail. Airbags, ammunition, explosives, gasoline. That's it. Those are the only things you definitely cannot, no matter who you are, send in the mail. And the list for restricted items is a little bit longer. Live animals, okay. And, cremated remains. So human ashes can be mailed domestically if they are in a strong, durable container, and they've got to be sent priority express mail. But back in 1913, when they launched parcel post, and that just means you can send packages through the mail, there weren't really any rules about what you couldn't send. It was just too new.
For the first time, people could send things through the mail that were weighed more than 4 pounds.
That's Nancy Pope, a curator at the Smithsonian's National Postal Museum.
And people took advantage of this to send pretty much everything they could find.
One newspaper sent a competing newspaper eggs.
And then the second newspaper returned by sending a cake baked with those eggs.
Parcel post was a huge success. People mailed 300 million packages in the first 6 months. In comparison, the post office now delivers 500 million pieces of mail a day. While it was good fun for some people, for others, like farmers or these brand new mail order catalogs, it was an invaluable way to do business. And, as is human nature, some folks got a little carried away.
And one of those were the parents of May Pierstorf, who was a young girl who weighed 50 pounds, which was quite important, because 50 pounds was the limit for parcel post service. The parents could not afford to send her to visit her grandparents by train, but they could afford to send her by parcel post. So they got enough stamps to equal 50 pounds worth of weight. They attached the stamps to her sleeve.
May's uncle was a railway mail clerk, so when a train came in, they just put her aboard her uncle's mail car.
And she rode in the train car to the town to visit her grandparents. And this made the news, and it got a lot of other people thinking about the same sort of thing. And before you knew it, there were little babies and little children being sent in the mail, as it were, across the U.S.
Yep, that's right. People were handing off their pride and joys to the post office. Less than a month into the start of parcel post in 1913, the Postmaster General wrote the New York Times, saying that he'd received questions on how exactly one would wrap a baby so that it would comply with shipping regulations.
When these stories were popping up in the news, some of them, you know, quite honest and real, some of them no doubt fictionalized, but all playing on the idea that the Post Office Department was the answer to this question of, you know, how can one child or one baby be passed from family member to family member inexpensively.
Pretty easily, it turns out. In mid-January 1914, the son of Mr. and Mrs. Jesse Bugh of Glen Est, Ohio, was carried by rural free delivery for about a mile to his grandmother, Mrs. Lois Bugh. His folks paid 15 cents and, very nurturingly, insured him for $50. A couple of weeks later, the Savis family of Pine Hollow, Pennsylvania, sent their daughter to relatives in Clay Hollow using 45 cents worth of stamps.
That's what most of these little kids were in these babies. It was instances of visiting family members who were not that far away. In some cases, they were on the same rural route.
And that's why mailing kids wasn't as big of a risk as you might think. Back then, most Americans lived in rural areas. The mail carriers on the routes were men that they knew well, and people could trust them to tote their little ones between towns as an affordable way to travel. At least one family used parcel post for a seriously long trip. In 1915, 6-year-old Edna Neff, who just squeaked in under the 50-pound limit, was mailed by parcel post from her mother in Pensacola, Florida, to her dad's house in Christiansburg, Virginia. Grand total, 15 cents.
It was not illegal to do it because the Postmaster General and the lawmakers never thought that was going to be an issue.
In 1920, Congress put an official end to everyone's fun. They passed a law that made it a federal crime to mail humans, regardless of weight. Though, don't dismay, just because you can't send your adorable baby in the mail doesn't mean there isn't a whole bunch of other weird stuff the post office will deliver for you, including slapping postage on a coconut or a flip-flop. And while I might not be encouraging you exactly, I do love getting mail. We're talking about loopholes, but loopholes aren't always easy to find. Let's take something that's in the news a lot right now. Race. If being white or black or Asian gave you an advantage that you couldn't otherwise get, could you find the loophole that let you be a part of that race after all? That was an important question if you were an immigrant in America about 100 years ago, because the immigration laws were pretty clear and pretty strict. At first, there was only one rule. If you were a free white person of good character, then you could apply for citizenship. After the Civil War, you could also be a citizen if you were of African nativity or descent. Then, in the late 1800s, the government started passing laws about who wasn't allowed in. Here's Adriel Lewis, a curator for the Smithsonian's Asian Pacific American Center.
Between the late 1800s through the early to mid-1900s, there are a number of different policies and acts with, for example, in 1882, the Chinese Exclusion Act, that was the first piece of legislation that specifically pointed out a group of people saying that you can't come here.
If you're Asian, that means you were pretty much out of luck. But there was one man, Bhagat Singh Thind, who wanted to become a citizen anyway. Thind came from India to the States in 1913. He was a PhD student at Berkeley, and he worked at lumber mills in the summer to pay for school. He even enlisted in the U.S. Army during World War I.
There's a historic photo of him dressed up as a soldier, holding a rifle with a turban. And this is during World War I, and that's him as a U.S. soldier.
Thind was also pretty deeply connected to India. For example, he was a major supporter of Indian independence. He was involved in the Gadar movement, which was a group of Indian immigrants who hoped to secure freedom for their home country from British rule.
Thind, I think he, in a lot of ways, reflects sort of the kind of sentiment that we see today with the diaspora, in that he was not concerned with only identifying solely as American.
While enlisted in the army, Thind was granted citizenship despite his ethnicity. But after just 4 days, the government took it back. So Thind tried again in 1920. This time, though, he had his loophole. See, you could be a citizen if you were white, but it wasn't clear what being white actually meant. Some scientists thought being white meant your ancestors were Caucasians. They relied on stuff like skull shapes and languages and genes as so-called scientific evidence. And that evidence claimed that Caucasian went beyond the Caucasus Mountains. It included people from a lot of places. People from Northwest India. People like Bhagat Singh Thind. He was born in Amritsar, close to the border between India and Pakistan.
And so he said, well, if you look at the science and you look at the roots of certain languages, you look at certain histories of conquests, because we are a conquering people to some parts of India, that he counts as Aryan, as Caucasian, and therefore as white.
Some courts had already given citizenship to other Indians based on the same argument. So Thind applied for citizenship, but the U.S. Bureau of Naturalization blocked him. He started appealing his case in federal courts, and it eventually went all the way to the Supreme Court. At the same time, he was watching the case of Takao Ozawa, a Japanese American. There, the case focused on skin color, not ancestry. Ozawa had been living in the U.S. for most of his life. He grew up in a mostly white community, spoke English, was Christian, and he had raised his kids in American culture.
It's not that he was denying the fact that he was Japanese. At the same time, he very much kind of grew up like apple pie America.
That didn't matter to the courts. Ozawa was Japanese, and that was that. So he tried a different tactic.
He took a case all the way up to Supreme Court, stating that he counts as free white, and the reason being that he was free, and because his skin tone was as light, if not lighter, than people who counted as white. And so there are points in the court case where he's actually like pointing out like underneath his arm and different parts of his body and like comparing himself to like Italians and things like that and saying, if you're going to say white, I'm white.
The justices were not having it.
The science of the day says that you cannot be an American citizen.
That's from the court's unanimous opinion. Skin color wasn't enough. Sharing American values wasn't enough. Assimilation was not enough. In order to be considered white, you had to be of the Caucasian race. That all sounded pretty good for Beghat Singh Thind, until his own case got to the Supreme Court, and the justices said,
well, you may scientifically count as Caucasian, but when it comes to public sentiment, you are not white. And so at that point, they kind of threw that science out the window and instead deferred it to, quote, the common man. And they said that the common man will look at you and other people of Indian descent and not see a white person, and therefore you don't qualify for U.S. citizenship.
And the ruling even cited Ozawa's case, amending its prior definition of white. The court said it was clear, no matter what the science, you know a white guy when you see one, and that's who gets to be a citizen. Caucasian was nothing but a conventional word of much flexibility. Loophole closed. The decision had some terrible consequences for Indian Americans. The government revoked the citizenship of around 50 people between 1923 and 1927. In California, you needed to be a citizen to own land. So, without citizenship, imagine
being a U.S. citizen for a couple of decades, and then you no longer have that citizenship, which means you also no longer have rights to your land that you own. That land was basically taken from them and then resold to white folks. And so all that kind of led to a sentiment that allowed for certain things like the Japanese American incarceration to happen during World War II.
The ruling basically stopped anyone from the Eastern Hemisphere from being a U.S. citizen, and it stayed that way for more than two decades. It wasn't until 1946 that the law changed and the government established a small quota for Indians. Today, there are almost 20 million Asian Americans, and those restrictions sound insane. Ancient history. But Adriel sees how those old laws can still shape American society.
One of the biggest echoes that still remains today is this idea of the perpetual foreigner. And so there is this stereotype that definitely doesn't just apply to Asian Americans, but is something that resonates very deeply in our community, that you can be, you know, someone who just immigrated here last week, or you can be fourth, fifth, or sixth generation, but just the fact that you are Asian, people will automatically assume that you're not from here or that you weren't born here. And I think that we really see that sort of become a part of an American mentality that we haven't quite wiped off. Now, we are living in a society where you definitely can become a U.S. citizen as an Asian American, but even being a citizen, even being born here, doesn't necessarily mean that you have the privilege of walking down the street and everybody acknowledging that you are American.
What it means to be American is something that we still debate. And in some ways, the answer is just as complicated now. We're a country of diversity shaped by immigrants and our nation's own history.
Now this this here is a story about the Rock Island Line. Well, the Rock Island Line, she runs down into New Orleans.
This is Johnny Cash playing Rock Island Line. It's about a train engineer who dupes a depot agent to skip paying a fine. The engineer swears he's carrying livestock.
I got cows, I got pigs, I got sheep, I got mules, I got all livestock.
But once the train is passed, the engineer turns and brags. There aren't pigs on this train, just lots and lots of pig iron. The kind you definitely need to pay a toll for. Rock Island Line is a legendary tune. It birthed a music craze in the UK in the 1950s, becoming a number one hit. Versions have been done by the likes of Bobby Darin, The Weavers, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, Johnny Cash, who you just heard, but it didn't start out that way. Jeff Place is a curator for the Folkways Collection, the Smithsonian's nonprofit record label. He says Rock Island Line actually started as a chain gang chant in the prison fields of Arkansas.
John Lomax, the famous song collector from the Library of Congress, he'd help get Leadbelly out of prison, and Leadbelly worked as his driver for a short while. And they were going down and recording in Arkansas, a place called Cummins State Farm, a prison, quarters this group of convicts singing. And what they did is they use it as a work song. You know, when they're working on chopping wood, they'd sing songs to help coordinate the timing of the chopping. But they also entertain themselves during the long, hot summer days down there. And they were singing Rock Island Line.
John Lomax and his son Alan spent years in the South collecting African-American folk and work songs from prisons.
Leadbelly really liked the song. He was sort of a musical sponge. His whole life, he was a guy who played guitar and a couple other instruments. He was one of the most important people in the 20th century as far as folk music goes, you know, just because he saved so much. He just gathered all these songs he'd hear and recombine them into things. He could take some melody he heard and memorize it, bring it back and kind of play with it.
I had a little woman waking on that natural deep end.
Leadbelly came up playing his 12-string guitar in rowdy bars and on street corners in northwestern Louisiana. He liked to fight. So much so that that's the reason he wound up in prison. Twice. Once for manslaughter and once for attempted manslaughter. He spent nearly 20 years on prison chain gangs, singing.
Just because she was working, making so much dough.
In fact, it was in a prison in Louisiana that the Lomaxes first recorded Leadbelly. For the Lomaxes, he was an amazing find. A folk singer who loved the blues, Leadbelly could do gospels, sea shanties, children's songs, pop. And so when he was released, they hired him as their driver on these trips around the country, recording prison songs, including Rock Island Line.
So he picks up this song, you know, with John Lomax, and next thing you know, he's added it to his own repertoire, and he's added this entire rap at the beginning about this guy trying to fool the guy at the depot agent.
Go to the train whistle, talk to the depot agent. Depot agent, throw that switchboard over the line.
There he's telling audiences about the depot agent at the switchboard. In performances over the years, Leadbelly would always first tell the funny little tale of this freeloading train before singing that song. It was a good story, but it wasn't the truth. The song is actually a company jingle for the railroad line.
Folklorist named Stephen Wade actually just did some research in the last few years and uncovered the fact that actually there was a contest at the Rock Island Line Railroad with the employees who could write the greatest jingle for Rock Island Line. And one of the employees came up with this jingle and won the prize. And it was sort of an ad that was on the radio, perhaps. And somehow people picked it up and were singing it. The folklorists all thought this was a great old folk song, you know, out of African-American, you know, culture and all of this.
So this funny little song, first thought to be a gritty work chant, that became a classic performed by every respectable folk singer, is actually the kind of thing written for company picnics. But frankly, that train conductor of the song is crafty, and Leadbelly was too. The backstory he invented is actually way more appealing than the truth. And the tune?
Rock Island Line.
Catchy, too.
This is one road I never have rode. But I heard tell that it ain't all that the song says it is.
There are a lot of loopholes out there if you just keep your eyes open. Technicalities, escape clauses, tricks to work the system. Maybe next time you find one, you too can pass off your pig iron for real pigs. Or whatever it is you're hoping to get away with.
And just outside of New Orleans is a big toll gate. And all the trains that go through the toll gate, well, they gotta pay the man some money.
That is the story about the Rock Island.
Now, the Rock Island line's a railroad line, and it runs down into New Orleans.
I got livestock, I got livestock, I got all livestock.
Engineer gonna talk to the depot agent with his whistle. And here's what he's gonna say.
Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. Rock Island Line is the road to
ride. The Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. If you want us to ride, you got to ride it like you're fine. Get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
Thanks for listening to Side Door. To see photos of these baby-carrying mailmen, read a digital comic about the Asian Pacific American story, or learn more about Leadbelly, go to si.edu/sidedoor. Hat tip to Danny Lewis at Smithsonian.com, who initially covered our postal story. Smithsonian.com has a ton of great original reporting, so check it out. This episode was produced by Megan Dietry and Kat Roman. Production support by Tony Cohn. Editing support by Max Rosenthal. Jason Orfanin is our executive producer. Megan Dietry is the series producer. Special thanks to Nico Picaro, Barbara Rehm, Gabe Kosowitz, and Jess Sadek. We are always interested in your feedback, so write a review or get in touch with us on our website. And thanks.